Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to episode number 19 of the Scottish History Podcast. My name is Owen Innes and this week we're going to be talking about one of my favourite subjects in relation to Scotland. We're going to be talking about whiskey. Now, of course, you know, I think we're all wanting to hear stories of Scotland's past and things like that. But what I'm going to be doing from sort of now on is to kind of really focus on some of the kind of lighter hearted things, and then we'll work our way, you know, so every so often there will be a big story. I'm going to be working on ones that have been suggested, so we've got the Highland Clearances, even just a podcast based around Edinburgh and things. What I'll maybe be doing though is taking stuff like Edinburgh, Glasgow, the cities of Scotland, and maybe making them into a series of podcasts. I think you can do that in some sort of way, you know, so this will be the first series, so to speak, and then we'll do specific ones about specific regions and things like that. But one that has been very highly requested is of course the Highland Clearances, so I will get onto that within the next couple of weeks. A little update with how things are going at the moment. I'm currently building a kind of studio in the spare room of my flat, so I've been here for 2 years. I've been planning on doing it for 2 years, so we're going to get around to it fairly soon, hopefully within the next week or so. In 2 weeks' time, I'm actually off work for an entire week, so I certainly plan on doing a lot of stuff then, sitting and writing some episodes. And with episodes like the one that I've got for you today, it didn't take me very long to write it at all, because it's all kind of in my head already. When it comes to stuff like the Highland Clearances and stuff, I want to do it justice and I want to make sure that you get the right information there. So bear with me on that one. You've all been incredibly kind in waiting for various podcasts and stuff, but I just wanted to get one out for you this week. I'm really hoping that you enjoy it. Whether or not you enjoy whiskey or not, to me, it doesn't really matter, because I've taken people who are teetotalers on whiskey tours to whiskey distilleries. They find the process absolutely amazing. I'm the same as well. I never used to be a whiskey drinker. I was 30 years old when I sat down and drank my first single malt whiskey and enjoyed it. I used to hate whiskey. I mean, bourbon, Jack Daniels, Jim Beam, these sorts of things. I used to love those type of whiskies with a little lemonade. Yeah, sue me, I'm weird. But when it comes to whiskey, I used to hate the stuff. Then I found a good one. Then I found a better one. So even if you don't like whiskey just now, I will be doing, I want to kind of do maybe a monthly kind of bonus episode where basically I just sit down with one of my favourite whiskies and either talk to you. I might do it live, I could do it as a podcast. You put down in the comments below on wherever it is that you're listening to, or on the Facebook page or whatever, send me a recommendation. Would you like it to be a live thing, just once a month, where we can sit down and we can have a little chat, and I'll introduce you to one of my sort of favourite whiskies once a month. I don't have very many of them, so that would maybe be, I've maybe got a year's worth of once a month. I've maybe got about 12 or so. Anyway, folks, I digress. Let's get into today's episode. And again, today's episode is all about whiskey. So the term whiskey is the anglicised version of the old Gaelic word for water. So it basically just means water. In Latin, however, the term for distilled alcohol, of which whiskey is referred to, was aqua vitae, which basically means the water of life. And whiskey's kind of taken this on. So some people refer to whiskey as aqua vitae as well. So the water of life, and let me assure you of this, whiskey certainly brings life to any party that it gets introduced to. So there are traditionally two separate spellings of the word whiskey. Now, we'll start off here. So, many whiskies that are made in the US or in Ireland, they tend to be spelled W-H-I-S-K-E-Y. So there's an E in there. That's the most important part. There are a couple of exceptions to this, however. There's no specific rule behind it, however. So, Maker's Mark, for example, which I think is a bourbon, again made in the United States, Maker's Mark is referred to as a whiskey, W-H-I-S-K-Y, so no E. So there's no particular rule as to how you spell whiskey, except when you're referring to Scotch whiskey or a whiskey made elsewhere. So we are quite particular about it. But basically, if you're referring to most US or Irish whiskies, it's going to be spelt with the E. So apart from that, or aside from that, all whiskey made outside of these countries, including Scotland, drop the E completely. So we have it W-H-I-S-K-Y. So that could be whiskey made anywhere else in the world, which includes Scotland. So that could be Japan, could be Sweden, Germany, England, could be anywhere else in the world, really, aside from the US and Ireland, that spell whiskey without the E. However, of course, we're not here to talk about whiskey from anywhere else except the whiskey made in Scotland. So just remember, though, when you are talking about your favourite Scotch whiskey, to spell it correctly. So say it with me, W-H-I-S-K-Y, no E. So Scotch, as you can probably tell by now, is whiskey made in Scotland. However, never call a Scottish person a Scotch person, please. This can be seen as a derogatory term. We do not like being called Scotch people. We are not the Scotch people from Scotchland. Not everybody likes whiskey. So, for example, I never used to be a Scotch person. Now I am a Scotch person because I like Scotch whiskey. But you would never refer to me as a Scotchman or a Scotch person. So we're not made from whiskey. Essentially, though, there are a few prefixes which, you can use the term Scotch for. So Scotch tape, for example, but that's the brand. You've also got what somebody said to me on a tour once, butterscotch. I don't think that's traditionally from Scotland. But of course, one of our other sort of famous exports, the Scotch egg. To be technical about it, though, most Scottish people do come from Scotch eggs. And if you get that, then, of course, you're having a little chuckle to that one. So the first record of whiskey in Scotland. Whiskey had been made elsewhere in the world long before this, but the first record of it is in 1494 in what was known as the Exchequer Rolls, and it indicates malt being sent to a friar called John Corr, C-O-R, to make aqua vitae. That's what the roll said, which was being used as medicine at the time. So most whiskey that was, or most distilled alcohol that was being made at the time, tended to be made by monks in monasteries. In 1506, up the ways from me in Dundee, James IV of Scots purchased a large amount of whiskey due to his liking for the spirit. He was a bit of a whiskey drinker himself. From then, it appears as though distilling moved away from the monasteries and into people's homes and farmsteadings as monks started to move away from the monasteries into a sort of more independent role outside of the monastery. In 1608, the world's first and still to this day oldest whiskey distillery opened over the water in Ireland. It is called the Old Bushmills Distillery. Quite a nice wee whiskey they make there. In 1707 and the Union of Scottish and English Parliaments, the taxes for whiskey rose dramatically. And in 1725, the English introduced a further malt tax, which forced the Scots to start distilling illegally. Mainly the distilling would happen at night, or during the moonshine, therefore given as the term moonshine. This was to prevent the taxmen from being able to see the smoke and vapour being given off by the stills making the whiskey. At one point as well, it is estimated that over half of the whiskey that was being produced in Scotland at one time was being done so illegally. In 1823, the Excise Act was passed that once again legalised distillation in Scotland, but for a fee. Highland distilleries tend to pay higher fees than lowland distilleries. I know of a distillery that, although distills in the Highlands, its maturation warehouses are literally across the road in the lowlands. This was due to a very kind taxman back in the day, and said distillery gets a tax break due to this. From 1920 until 1933 in the US, prohibition was introduced, banning all sales of alcohol. Whiskey, however, was exempt if prescribed by a doctor. For this reason, the popular Walgreens pharmacy stores in the United States rose from just 20 to over 400 in that 13-year period. So how is whiskey made? Now, I'm going to be predominantly from here talking about single malt whiskies. I will explain different types of whiskey that you can normally get in Scotland or other whiskies which are referred to as Scotch whiskies, but this is the process of making a single malt whiskey. So most whiskey is made from using large copper kettles called stills. Copper is used to remove any sulphur-based compounds from the finished drink, which would make the drink unpleasant. So to make a single malt whiskey, you only need three ingredients: water, yeast, and malted barley. So the first one, most people have heard of barley, but not many people know about malted barley. So malted barley, you take water, so water is added to the barley and spread on a malting floor and turned every so often to allow germination to take place. After three or so days, the barley is then dried, either with hot air or via a peat-fueled fire. Now, if you've not heard of peat before, peat isn't a guy that lives down the road. Peat is spelled P-E-A-T. Peat is basically the very early formations of coal. It's a few layers underneath your normal mud layer in your garden. However, it only tends to form in very boggy places, so out on marshes and things like that. So basically it's all of the mulch, so things like dead leaves, branches and bark and reeds and grass, everything that starts to decompose down into the ground. Millions of years will pass by and it will solidify and turn into what we know as coal. However, the peat that will, just a few layers underneath, it's quite a spongy, springy sort of thing. So we dig that out of the ground and then we leave it for a few days for it to dry. Believe it or not, we leave it outside in Scotland to dry. Someone explain how that makes any sense. But essentially, we just leave it out to dry, and then when you take a flame to it, you know, a match or a lighter, obviously nowadays, you take a flame to it and it burns nice and evenly, nice and slowly. So they used to use peat fires in houses, but in terms of the whiskey industry, that's where you'll find most of the peat fires these days. So when the peat fire dries out the malt itself retains the smoky, it retains the smoke from that fire in the barley grain itself, and then in the finished whiskey article, you'll have quite a smoky flavour going on there. Traditionally, a lot of these smoky whiskies tend to be from Islay, I-S-L-A-Y. Once again, if you're pronouncing it Islay, it's not Islay, it's Islay. Again, say it with me, Islay. Or Campbellton on the west coast of Scotland. That's not to say they are only exclusively from these places. That is wrong. You can get smoky whiskies from the lowlands and elsewhere. Again, though, that's all just on how they dry out the barley. So the now dried barley is added to even more water and is slowly heated, forming what's known as mash. And finally, yeast is added to begin the fermentation of this mash. Once fermented, again between 3 and 4 days later, the liquid resembles beer, and it sits around between 6 and 7% alcohol by volume mark, which is roughly, for those of you that don't deal with ABV and deal in proof, you're talking between 12 and 14 proof. So when I'm talking ABV, you simply double it, and that's where you get your proof measure from. This beer is then pumped into a copper still, which is boiled. Now bear in mind that alcohol boils at a lower temperature than water. Now, as the beer starts to boil in the bottom of the still, vapour starts to rise to the top of the still. Now, on the top of the still, it's not an open still, okay? So this is all harnessed, everything is harnessed. So the vapour rises to the top of the still, and it goes into the neck of the still, which again is usually made from copper. So it starts to rise, it goes into the neck of the still or the arm of the still, and it starts to flow down. Now this arm of the still is usually surrounded in a condenser. So to simplify it as much as possible, so you've got the vapour rises up into the arm of the still and it starts to kind of float down. It's being forced down with all of the new vapour coming in, forced through the arm, and it eventually reaches the condenser, which is essentially the arm. The copper arm is surrounded by really, really cold water. That then condenses that vapour back into liquid. So the liquid then starts running down and into the spirit chamber. So basically what we've done is we've taken between 6 and 7% beer and we've turned it into a spirit. So the beer in the bottom of the still is now essentially useless. We tend to take that, which I think is called grist, we tend to take that and we ship it off to the cows in the field. So the cows tend to get fed off of that, off of the barley and stuff which is sitting at the bottom of the still. So, but this spirit that gets made, this vapour which gets turned back into liquid, is now a spirit. And the spirit, depending on which part of the distillation process, be it the first part or the second part, can be anything up to between 50 and 75% alcohol by volume. So you've taken, say, a 7% beer and you've turned it into a 70% alcoholic spirit. Dangerous, but very, very nice. So the product is usually distilled twice. So the first time round you don't get quite the strength of which we're looking for. Now, all whiskey, any whiskey in which you buy, it must be bottled at 40% alcohol by volume or above. You will not get a 39.9% alcohol by volume whiskey, because that doesn't exist. It has to be 40 or above. Okay, so we take the roughly, so say an average of what we're getting out of this spirit is sitting roughly about 70% alcohol by volume after the second distillation. The first distillation, what we're getting, we tend to call low wines. So it's, you know, it's low quality or low in volume, low in alcoholic volume. So that tends to get distilled again. So that get pumped back in with the rest of the beer, usually added in with a little bit of extra of that beer, I'm using inverted commas here, redistilled, and then it will come out even stronger. So the second time, it's referred to as the heart of the distillation process. So this is the good stuff. All right. So all of the spirit that we now get, and as I said, this is up to the 75% alcohol by volume stuff, is now called new make spirit, because we're now going to start to make something new. So we take that. Now, again, if we just think that on average it's about 70% alcohol by volume, what we then do is we take some water and we add more water to this, to bring the alcohol percentage down to exactly 62.5% alcohol by volume. We bring it down to exactly that. And from there, the maturation can begin. Now, Scottish single malt whiskey, or Scotch whiskey if you prefer, can only be matured in oak casks. You might refer to them as barrels, but in the industry they're known as casks. So it's only an oak cask. We will never use any other type of wood for making a Scotch whiskey. It must be oak. It's one of the whiskey making laws. Most casks, therefore, tend to be bought from abroad. Now, we do have some cooperages in Scotland, so a cooperage is where they will make their own casks. We do have a few of those. There's not many of them. I think there might be six. Without researching it, I don't know, some of this is just coming off the top of my head here. But there aren't many cooperages left in Scotland, or certainly not at whiskey distilleries. So we're not really making our own casks. Some distilleries will have a cooperage that will literally just rebuild the casks which are being sent from abroad. So we tend to buy them from places like America, Spain, France, Italy, anywhere that we can really get our hands on a good quality oak cask. So, for example, if we buy them from America, American whiskies and bourbons, they have specific laws for making them as well. When they make bourbons or Tennessee whiskies or whatever, the casks in which they use to mature their whiskey can only be used once. So these are brand new. So they're knocking down oak trees, they're building brand new virgin casks, they're making Jack Daniels in it. Once they've made Jack Daniels in that one cask can never be used again. So we buy them, and we can use them as many times as we want. So Scotch whiskies are matured in ex-bourbon, rum, port, wine, sherry, or even cider casks. That's just to name a few. So when you look on the bottle of a Scotch whiskey, you'll probably see bourbon cask finish or sherry cask or whatever it's been matured inside. Sometimes you'll find more than one. So it'll be a mixture of whiskey taken from a bourbon cask and a sherry cask. For example, one of my early favourites was the Tomatin 12-year-old single malt. That's from ex-bourbon and sherry casks, a mixture of the two. Very nice whiskey as well, I must admit. So the new make goes into the casks completely clear. So how does the whiskey get its colour? So it goes in clear as day. It's like vodka. I actually have a bottle of new make spirit in my house here. I've opened it and I've smelled it. I've never actually tasted it yet. I will get round to it one day. Perhaps we can do that on a live video and see how mental I get. But basically, the new make spirit goes into these wooden casks completely clear. So how does it get that sort of caramel colour that everyone knows about? Well, another law to making single malt whisky is that it must mature in those oak casks for a minimum of 3 years and 1 day. Sitting for the 3 years and 1 day, for that minimum, I should say, of 3 years and 1 day inside of that cask, the cask breathes. So if you imagine the cask like a lung, as it gets hot outside, it starts to expand. The wood starts to expand. It lets the liquid into the grains of the wood. And then at night time, it gets a little bit colder. And as it gets colder, the wood starts to tighten up or contracts, and it pushes some of that liquid back out. Now you imagine that happening over 3 years, over 10 years, 15, 20, you're starting to get the gist here. Yeah, so it's taking on the flavours of the wood and the colours as well of the wood, but it'll also be taking on similar colours. For example, one of the best examples we can use here is with port. Port is quite a dark kind of red wine colour. Okay, so if you put the new make spirit into an ex-port cask, as it goes in, it'll come out, it'll be quite a deep red colour in comparison to that caramel sort of colour that you're more used to perhaps with Jack Daniels, etc. So that's how it gets its colour. Now, I mentioned before that it must mature for a minimum of 3 years and 1 day. What I want you folks to do, have a little think about that. Why must we add on that extra 1 day? And what to do is comment on the Twitter, on the Facebook, or on the Instagram, or whatever the post which this is related to. Comment on that, folks, and let me know your thoughts as to why whiskey must mature in Scotland for 3 years and 1 day. Why the extra day? Have a think about it. It's not quite as complicated as you would think. So the whisky goes into the cask, it gets wheeled into warehouses, and it's left there for the minimum of 3 years and 1 day. Say, for example, we're leaving it there for 10 years. The longer that the whisky is left in the cask to mature, the less whisky there will be in the cask at the end of the maturation time. Now, this is because alcohol will evaporate. So like the fact that alcohol boils at a lower temperature, alcohol evaporates at a lower temperature than water as well. So the length of time it spends sitting in the cask, going through all of these extreme temperature changes and things like that, eventually what will happen is some of this will start to escape and it will start to evaporate. And this is recorded as a loss every year to the whisky industry, but the whisky industry is not punished for it. This is recorded as the angels' share. So the angels get their share as it evaporates and up into the sky for the angels to have their little dram on the clouds. So eventually the master distiller and the master blender will believe that the whisky is ready to put out to the public. They'll take it and they'll pop it into some bottles and they'll sell it to us. So there's a few things that I do like to kind of put out there when we are talking about whisky, folks, all right? One of those things is age statements. Do not get snobby about age statements on whisky, all right? Some people say, I will only drink whisky that's 30 years old. Well, if you've got £300, £400, £500 to spare, good sir, then please send it in my direction. All right, you're not really drinking anything any better. Whisky is all subjective. All right, I tend to prefer whiskies aged between 12 and probably between, there's a few 21s out there that I like. But basically, whiskies aged between 12 years and 21 years, they fall perfectly within my bracket. Now, I cannot afford a 21-year-old whisky every year, let alone every 5 years. Okay, that's a little treat that I'll maybe have every so often. But basically, what the age statement on a bottle of whisky means is you pick up, you go to the local store, okay, and you pick up, say, a bottle of Balvenie. Right, we'll just talk about Balvenie here. So you pick yourself up a bottle of Balvenie 12-year-old single malt. The 12-year-old single malt on that bottle, what that means is, or the 12 years, what that means is the youngest whiskey in that bottle is 12 years old. All whiskies are blended in some way. So, say for example, just for argument's sake, you'll have 70% of that bottle will be 12 years old whiskey. Then say 10% of that will be 14-year-old whiskey. Another 10% of that, 15-year-old. And then just to top it off, that extra little 10% can be 50-year-old whiskey, right? But they're not going to put on the bottle that it's 50-year-old single malt, because that's untrue. The youngest whiskey that they are selling you is aged 12 years old. So that's what an age statement on the bottle means. Okay, so just because it says 8 years, 10 years, that's something quite young, and then you see other ones on the shelves that are, you know, 21, 25, 30 years old, you know, don't worry about them. Don't think that by buying a 12-year-old single malt for someone that it's more important to buy the more expensive one. It really isn't. It really, really isn't. And the reason why, as well, I should add here, the reason why the older ones tend to be more expensive is, as I explained, the longer you leave the whiskey in the cask for, the more it evaporates. Therefore, the less that you have to sell. So the older the whiskey is, the more rare that whiskey is going to be, hence the inflated price tag on there. So once again, folks, don't get snobby about age statements. With Isla whiskies, I like 8 and 10 year old Isla whiskies. Anything above that, not a huge fan of. Usually sort of about 10 years for the really heavily peated, really heavily smoky whiskies, because the whiskey tends to still be young enough that there's a sweetness in there. And I've got a bit of a sweet tooth, I'm not going to lie. With Highland whiskies, I tend to, again, as I mentioned before, start round about the 12 years and above after that. So finally, folks, now that you know the process of making a single malt whiskey, let me explain what single malt means. Single malt, it's very simple to denote, right? So single malt means that it's made, that the product, every inch of that bottle, every little drop that you will find in that bottle was made in one single distillery from malted barley. That's it. Simple as that. So one single distillery from malted barley. That's what single malt means. Now, there are other different types of whiskies that you can get there. So if you have two or more single malt whiskies from two or more different distilleries that are together in one bottle, these are known as blended malts. So blended malt whiskies, blended single malt whiskies. But they can't be called single malt, they're blended malts. Right? A very popular blended malt at this moment in time is called Monkey Shoulder. Very, very nice. It's got some Balvenie in there. It's got some Glenmorangie and Kininvie, I believe it is. Very, very nice whiskey. Very, even for sipping, it's good as well if you prefer to add a little something to your whiskey. And finally, another one is blended whiskies. Right, you can also get something called a blended whiskey. Now, blended whiskey are not made using malted barley. Okay, so the process is not using malted barley whatsoever. First of all, they start off making so the same process that we went through before, but instead of using malted barley, they will use another grain, for example, corn, like what they use in the US. So they'll make a grain spirit, not a whiskey, a grain spirit. So it's basically the moonshine, if you will, the new make spirit that they get from using the corn. They add that into a bottle. So once again, for argument's sake, we'll use 60% of your bottle of blended whiskey. So that could be Famous Grouse, it could be Bell's, Johnny Walker. These are all blended whiskies. So 60% of that is an inferior grain whiskey. Now, inferior grain is just what the industry, I suppose, would call it. So 60% of that bottle is grain whiskey, and the other 40% is made up of a mixture of up to 50 different types of single malt whiskies. And they're only added those little drops of single malt whiskies here and there just to add the colour and flavour. It's not, or it tends not to be matured in a cask for any length of time. It's also very highly likely that something called E150A, so Echo 150 Alpha, better known to most of us as caramel food colouring, will be added to make the bottle appear more appealing. So those last two that I mentioned, single malts, what can you have in a single malt? Everyone always asks that, so we'll come to that one last. In terms of your blended whiskies and blended malt whiskies, if the bottle says blended on it, you can do with that whatever you want. You buy that bottle, you can immediately walk out the shop and throw it on the floor if you want to. We don't really care about them. There are nice blended malts out there, there are nice blended whiskies out there, but really the cream of the crop is the single malts. In terms of blended whiskey, there's a couple out there that I like, and I like, there's one called McNamara, which is made by the Gaelic whiskies on the Isle of Skye, or sold by the Gaelic whiskies on the Isle of Skye. I'm not quite sure exactly where it's made. Shevaik as well, which is very nice, same company, the Gaelic whiskies. In terms of blended malts, I can't really recommend any more than Monkey Shoulder. Honestly, it's one of the best. So with them, you can have ice, you can have water, you can put lemonade in them, you could add them into any cocktail which you fancy, Coca-Cola, ginger beer, whatever. When it comes to single malt, folks, there's only one thing you should ever put into a single malt, and that is water. And by water, I mean a drop of water. If you really, really want to, 2 drops of water. Every drop of water that you add into a glass of whiskey is called an angel's tear, because they're crying at the fact that you need to water this wonderful spirit down any further. Ice, now this is where I enter into personal opinion territory right about now. The reason why I do not like putting ice into single malt whiskey is, again, we'll take a scenario. Okay, you go to McDonald's, you get yourself a nice Coca-Cola or Fanta. I'm a Pepsi man, so I would need to go to KFC for that. So let's go to KFC, we'll get ourselves a large Pepsi Max. Okay, now drinking it without the ice, it will taste the same all the way down to the bottom, apart from the fact it will get a little less carbonated. However, I add ice to that. 10 minutes later, my Pepsi Max has started to be watered down. I forget about it, and half an hour after that, basically my Pepsi now tastes like Pepsi that I've put half a gallon of water into, which is not a particularly nice taste. So when you think about that with whiskey, you put even one single block of ice into a glass of whiskey and you're taking your time with it, sipping and sipping and sipping. Even if you're sipping it over the course of 5-10 minutes, too much water is getting released into that whiskey. By the time you get down to your last little sips, it's just going to taste like watered down whiskey. It's not going to taste like whiskey with water in it. It's going to taste like watered down whiskey, which just is not nice in my opinion. These whiskey stones that apparently you keep them in the fridge are made out of granite or something like that. If you keep them in the fridge, they're going to get condensation on them. Therefore, it's going to be adding too much water for my liking. So what I recommend that you do is when you try a whiskey for the first time or try a new single malt for the first time, even if you're a seasoned drinker, always try your first sip. Always try it. So you sip it 3 times. So you take one sip, place it down on the counter and leave it for a minute or so. Let it work on your palate. Then take a second sip, place it back down on the table. Don't do anything to it. Let then you start to get the flavours, you know, then you start to taste things. Then on your third sip, if it's still a bit too like, no, I don't know about this, add a little drop of water in. Now, there's two easy ways to do this in a bar, especially if you're in a bar, even if you're at home. If you've got a straw, get a glass of water and then get, you know, place your finger, place the straw into the water and place your finger over the top of the straw and then plop it into the glass. Otherwise, the best way of doing it is with your finger. Take a finger and dip it into a glass of water. Bring your finger straight up. You will have one perfectly formed drop of water on the end of your finger. Bring it over your glass. Flick your finger against the edge of the glass. And then you'll get your one perfect drop of water. Swirl the glass around. Leave it for about a minute before taking your next three sips. And if you still think that you need to add a little bit more water in, add it in one drop at a time. So add as many drops in as you want, but start off with none. Work your way to one. And then what you'll start to find is you'll start to find that when you pick up that bottle of... go back to the Tomatin 12, one of my favourites. So when you pick up that bottle of Tomatin 12-year-old single malt and you pour it into the glass, you've had it numerous times before and you know, okay, with the Tomatin 12, you like three drops of water in that. As soon as you pour it, three drops in and that's you. You've got your perfect dram of whiskey every single time and it's not watering down with melting ice, tasting absolutely revolting. In terms of mixing with cocktails, don't use single malts. Please don't use single malts. It's probably the nicest way I can do it. But if you buy, if you buy a bottle of single malt whiskey, it's yours. You can do with it as you wish. It's yours to do as you wish with it. Anyway, folks, that's, again, a good 40-odd minutes talking about whiskey. That's probably a record for me in terms of the least amount of time that I would talk about whiskey. And to be honest, there's a lot more I can go into. I would normally start giving little recommendations, but I do recommend those ones. So I mentioned Tomatin, 12-year-old, single malt, lovely, lovely single malt there. There was the Monkey Shoulder that I mentioned, Balvenie 12-year-old, check out the Balvenie 14-year-old Caribbean rum cask. That stuff is like juice. That stuff is the water of life. It's very, very easy to drink. And a little expensive, around about £50 or £60 a bottle. Don't know what that's going to be elsewhere. So anyway, folks, we'll leave that one there for just now. I just want to again thank you very much for listening. Thank you to those of you who are sharing the podcast. Again, once you've listened to the podcast or before you listen to the next episode, please, please, please share online, on Facebook, of course. So all of these links can be found at the Scott History Pod. I'm hoping to have a website or basically a web page that'll have the RSS details for the podcast. So you can basically go to the web page and find a link to every single place that this podcast is put out on, because I'm now fully up on the Acast. So Acast distributes to not just Spotify and Apple Podcasts, but to places like iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Google Play, I think even, just hundreds and hundreds of different places. That's why I decided to go for that. To those of you who are pledging on the Patreon every single month, that's all due to you folks helping to pay for that. That's running at about £160, I think. Thankfully it's for a full year, but I've been saving up over the last few months, put a little bit of my extra money in there, but basically it's all paid up until for the rest of the year. So there you go, folks. I'm not going anywhere, at least until that until that deals up next year, but I'm only joking. So basically the podcast will always be available no matter where. So if you are listening to this on, say, Spotify, but you prefer listening on iLoveRadio or Acast Player, even just have a search now for on your favourite podcasting place, search on there for the Scottish History Podcast and hopefully, fingers crossed, it should be there. And if it's not, send me a message and I will see if we can get it put on that platform. Just let me know. So I mentioned the Patreon there, folks. If you're new to the podcast, Patreon, whatever you want to call it, patreon.com/ScottHistoryPod. You can, if you enjoy the podcast and the content that I'm putting out here, you can pledge to me every single month. There's only two tiers. There's the affordable tier, which is just £1 per month. I believe it now automatically. So if you're in the US, for example, I believe it automatically is $1. So no matter where you are, it'll be one or three. I'm never going to have it any more than that. And the reason being is because, you know, I, like some of yourselves, might not want to, you know, pledge any more than that. If you do want to pledge more than that, though, folks, let me know, and I'd be more than happy to do that. But at the end of the day, you know, the Patreon or Patreon is basically there just to cover the costs of the podcast. Hopefully very soon I'm going to start getting out and about as well, so that will also help with like traveling costs and trying to do some field recordings. You know, I want to, there's a couple of places nearby where I live that I would like to start off and give that a try, and then hopefully go further afield as things progress. So anyway, folks, Facebook, so facebook.com/ScottHistoryPod. Twitter is at ScottHistoryPod. Instagram, ScottHistoryPod. The Acast link I'll post underneath this, so wherever you're listening to, again, Spotify, it'll come up in the description there. We're on YouTube, Spotify, Apple, Google Play, Google Podcasts, etc., as I say, and many, many more. So folks, once again, thank you very much for listening. This has again been another long podcast, because I just start rambling when I get into it. But once again, folks, thank you very much for your support. Thank you very much for listening, and I will see you again next time.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.